From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump will speak this afternoon in his first public event since refusing to concede 2 weeks ago. And besides making wild claims of election fraud, his strategy apparently now incorporates pressuring state officials not to certify election results. Today, he invited two Michigan lawmakers to the White House.
And President-elect Joe Biden says what President Trump is doing is dangerous.
He will go down in history as being one of the most irresponsible presidents in American history. It's just out of the, not even within the norm at all. There's questions whether it's even legal.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. Hey, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Tolu Olorunipah is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you, too.
And Tolu, let's start with you. Democrats have demanded a briefing on Monday from the Trump-appointed administrator who has the power to formally start this transition, but so far hasn't done so. At this point, Tolu, are Democrats and the Biden team getting to a stage where they're going to start pulling some punches and starting to fight back?
Yeah, you do see the Democrats starting to increase the amount of pressure, public pressure, and power pressure that they're putting on Republicans, on the Trump administration, to try to get them to start moving, because it's pretty clear at this point that Joe Biden has won the election. Most of the legal avenues that President Trump has tried to use to overturn the results have expired. The cases have been thrown out by judges. There has not been any evidence produced that would make it seem like President Trump could overturn the result of the election in multiple states. So Democrats are starting to get at their wits' end. They realize that not only is this something that is important for our democracy to be able to show the world that we know how to have a peaceful transfer of power, but logistically it's important that Joe Biden and his team get access to the information that they need, because we're in the middle of a couple of different crises right now, from the coronavirus pandemic and the public health crisis to the economy and the trouble that many Americans are facing in their own personal pocketbooks. So Democrats are saying they need to get access to this information, and they're going to put as much pressure as possible to get that done as soon as possible.
Well, in fact, in a briefing with reporters this morning, Biden campaign attorney Bob Bauer said Trump has lost a case every day in the courts for 2 weeks, and he blasted Trump for inviting two Republican state lawmakers from Michigan to the White House today in what appears to be an effort to prevent the certification of the vote in that state. Let's listen.
It's an abuse of office. It's an open attempt to intimidate election officials. It's absolutely appalling. Actually, in the context of all these losses and the record of failure that I just described, it's also pathetic.
Rick, help us understand what President Trump is up to in Michigan.
Well, this is extraordinary. Basically, what he's trying to tell state lawmakers is disregard what your voters said. He's not making the case to these lawmakers that he actually got more votes than Joe Biden. What he is making the case around is that, I think there's enough question about the validity of these results, about the actual election results, that you should insert your judgment for the judgment of the voters of the state of Michigan. 150,000 votes separate them, but he is saying to these lawmakers, look at the Constitution. It says that the state legislature can decide the way that electors are chosen, and you can go insert your judgment. Now, if this is not illegal, it is at least extra legal, because there's nothing in the law that accommodates this. Michigan or anywhere else that would allow a state legislature to just step in. There are so many obstacles in courthouses, in other state processes, but it is a rather crazy development that you'd have a president who's making that outright claim to say, don't worry what actually happened. Don't look at those results. Put my people in there instead. It is a wild, wild notion.
Georgia's Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said he's disappointed Trump lost, but he also said that he heads towards certifying the election results today. Let's listen.
Working as an engineer throughout my life, I live by the motto that numbers don't lie. As Secretary of State, I believe that the numbers that we have presented today are correct.
Meanwhile, in support of President Trump, officials in one county in Arizona have delayed certifying the election results until next week. Republican Congressman Paul Gosar said he supports that and the state should name its own electors. Is there any chance, Rick, that these strategies could work?
Very, very unlikely. There are so many obstacles standing in the way. But I think the handicapping the likelihood actually doesn't even do the story justice, because it is such an extraordinary development. I think it's going to be dismissed by lots of state folks. Even these lawmakers in Michigan have said this shouldn't be happening. But even the fact that it's entertained right now represents a new level for the Republican Party. This, of course, the RNC is behind a lot of these efforts. And the fact that lawmakers are talking about this openly is not something we've seen before. I don't see any way that this gambit succeeds, but it would be subverting the will of the voters.
Tolu, I got to ask you about Rudy Giuliani. I mean, he had what is described as a bizarre and some say dangerous news conference yesterday, claiming Biden was behind a multi-state and even international conspiracy to rig the election. But of course, Giuliani provided no hard evidence of it. Let's listen.
We're going to go to court. We're going to prove it in court. I would love to release all the information that I have. I would love to give it to you all, except most of you wouldn't cover it. A few of you would.
Tolu, this event was held at the Republican Party's national headquarters, and most Republicans have actually been silent on these claims. Why do you think that is?
Well, they're afraid of the president. They know that if they speak out, if they declare Biden the winner, as all of these various states have already done, then the president will see them as turncoats, as disloyal to him in his effort to try to hold on to power. So instead, they've remained quiet, and they've allowed that voices like Rudy Giuliani to dominate the party. And there's no way to overstate how bizarre and outlandish Giuliani's claims were. He essentially was saying that multiple states, multiple city local officials, Democrats and Republicans were involved in a national and international scheme to rig the election that no one knew about until after the election was over and Joe Biden was declared the winner. He said that Antifa was involved and George Soros was involved and Venezuela and Chavez were involved. All of these outlandish claims for which he provided no evidence and which really ended up becoming an embarrassment for the Republican Party, in that they are tied to this. This is their brand at this moment. And there are some Republicans who are uncomfortable with this and are starting to speak out, saying that that should not be the way that we handle post-election politics. But as you mentioned, most of them are being silent. Most of them are afraid of the president and are waiting for this to blow over.
Rick, could we just go back to what we heard Giuliani say there, which is, we're going to prove it in court. I would love to give you the information that I have, but I can't. I would love to give it to you all. They have had opportunity after opportunity in the court of law in these states where they're challenging the election results. They haven't shown anything. I mean, isn't that right? I mean, what does he have? What does Giuliani have to show everybody?
Is exactly right. Underline this, circle it, highlight it. There has been no court challenge that the Trump team has brought that brings anything close to the evidence you'd need to show that actually he won instead of Joe Biden in critical states. We're talking about margins of 12,000, 20,000. In the case of Michigan, 150,000 votes, and no evidence that's been presented through dozens of court cases that suggests that there's something wrongful about that. It's a lot of innuendo. It's a lot of rumor. Yeah, there could be some scattered instances where there's a few votes here or there, and they found a few votes in Georgia in the recount. But there has been no evidence after 2.5 weeks of this to do anything that would suggest that Joe Biden is anything other than the president-elect of the United States.
On CBS this morning, Health Secretary Alex Azar was asked about Joe Biden's claim that Trump's transition delay could cost lives in the pandemic. Let's listen to that.
It sounds like you're saying that that Joe Biden is incorrect when he says this delay is going to cost lives.
Absolutely incorrect.
Tolu, just what do you think about this as we transition here to the pandemic response? Does a delayed transition really make a difference in terms of lives being lost or what the Biden campaign can or cannot do in terms of responding to the virus?
It does. Transitions are hard, even under the best of circumstances. A new government has to come in and take over a multi-million number of employees and face a number of different challenges that the outgoing administration maybe didn't fully resolve before leaving office. And that is even discounting the fact that we have a pandemic that is killing thousands of Americans every day. We're at record high numbers. And we are at the beginning of the process of trying to secure a vaccine and make a plan to distribute it to 330 million Americans. That's a huge undertaking. It's going to require a lot of coordination, and not having that coordination between the outgoing and incoming administration
will potentially lead to lost lives.
Yeah, and you know, we keep asking this question every single day. We have less than a minute with both of you. But Rick, will the lame duck Congress be able to pass something to help people struggling during this pandemic?
I don't see it. I know that there's something that President-elect Biden is talking about with Democratic leaders today. It would certainly give his administration a jump start, but the paralysis is just so severe right now.
Rick Klein is political director at ABC News, and Tolu Olorunipa is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is proposing what he calls anti-mob legislation that would allow armed citizens to use force against anyone they see as engaged in criminal mischief against a business. This is part of a wave of legislation that criminalizes protesting during these times of social unrest. Nora Benavides has been tracking the bills in state houses around the country. She's director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America. Nora, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And what do you make of this effort in Florida that would expand the Stand Your Ground law and at least would appear to make it possible to kill people who are looting or damaging a business?
Well, part of what I find troubling is that this is really an introduction that is against the backdrop of another proposal in Florida, in which the governor has basically tried to put together some grab bag of harsh measures that would penalize protesters. And so together, so much of what we're hearing about in Florida is an effort to crack down on legitimate speech and on protest rights.
Another provision in that law would make it a felony to block traffic, which of course happens a lot during protests. But what kind of constitutional or legal questions do you think it brings up?
Well, it brings up who is speaking. You know, so much of what we've seen when we look at these trends now of anti-protest bills around the country seem to provide carve-outs for accepted behavior or accepted protest. And much of this gives law enforcement discretion to pick and choose when to use a criminal provision. You know, when to find that someone who's crossing a street is actually obstructing traffic and when they are not. And that kind of discretion could potentially lead to some people having First Amendment rights and others in practice being denied their First Amendment rights.
Well, as you just hinted there, Florida is nowhere near the only state to be passing these kinds of laws or considering these kinds of laws. What else have you noticed in other places?
You know, over the last several years, PEN America has been researching what we think is this explosion of anti-protest bills around the country. And really, since 2017, we've seen an explosion of almost 120 proposals now that would do something to either increase penalties for people exercising their rights, such as marching on sidewalks or roadways, or it would actually just create new types of criminal charges, a lot of which is what we see in Florida. And we're really convinced that that trend is moving more and more to create what are acceptable ways of exercising your rights, and then what are unacceptable ways.
And what kind of penalties are protesters facing if they end up breaking these new laws?
Well, frankly, it varies by state. And not all of these proposals have become law. Almost 25% of bills that are introduced do become law. The penalties range from, you know, what would have been, let's say, a very low-level misdemeanor for marching near a pipeline construction, now is a felony. It could then also be met with upwards of 5 years in prison as a sentence or a charge of over $10,000.
Wow. So just going to a protest could really mess with somebody's life.
Absolutely. You know, if you're thinking about protesting and you know this bill is on the books now, you may actually not express yourself. You may prevent yourself from being part of our public discourse because you're worried about not being able to pay the fine or, you know, what would it mean for your professional career if you were arrested for what's actually a protected right.
And are you seeing prosecutions under these new laws?
You know, we're not yet. We've seen kind of some be introduced and not become law. And then we've seen some that we're waiting to monitor what happens when they are, in fact, used. Most recently, we've had concerns just watching what's happened this past summer. And with the George Floyd protests and sort of the solidarity around racial justice, you know, there have been thousands of arrests. And many of those arrests are for small, low-level misdemeanors, which these laws around the country that we've examined are duplicative of. So what it really appears to do is simply chill people's sense of what their rights are and really make people think twice about, you know, should I protest and put my body on the line at the risk of maybe being charged with a felony or as a domestic terrorist? Or, you know, can I even face a $20,000 fine?
Well, and I'm wondering if the laws are being applied equally. For example, does it apply in the same way with an armed militiaman at the Michigan State House protesting COVID restrictions as it would, say, with like an indigenous group protesting an oil pipeline in North Dakota?
Absolutely. It's a great question. I think the other, though, is what is the framework and interests of our legislators from the outset? Because what they have done is pretty exclusively introduced proposals targeting tactics used by Black Lives Matter and anyone who would protest pipeline constructions, as you mentioned. And those are the tactics used for progressive social change.
So what do you predict is ahead under the Biden administration?
Well, first of all, I am very hopeful that a Biden administration will help bring about a rhetoric that is grounded in the rule of law and that our First Amendment and our free expression rights are protected ones that we adhere to. I still think that we need to be on guard against what state legislators may do all over the country. Just last week, there was a new anti-protest bill introduced in Ohio, which would, similar to what we've seen elsewhere, create very large and excessive charges for a variety of behaviors, you know, from rioting or looting, violence. And so I think that we're not going to see those types of bills go away. And we need people in states who are prepared to advocate on behalf of what our First Amendment rights are and why it's important to protest in the first place.
Nora Benavidez, Director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Well, since late May, when George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis, people have been protesting in the streets of Portland, Oregon, against police brutality and racism. And they've been met with a barrage of police-deployed munitions, including pepper spray and tear gas. And this has raised concerns about the effects of these gases, not just for the health of people, but also the environment. Monica Samayoa of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
On the west bank of the Willamette River, just south of downtown Portland, aquatic ecologist Juniper Simonis ties a rope to a tree and grabs a hold. It helps them stay steady while descending a steep hill crowded with thorny blackberry brambles. Simonis then navigates sharp, slippery rocks to get close enough to a culvert to collect water samples.
A lot of the kinds of chemicals that are included in these chemical weapon munitions that law enforcement are using are detrimental to ecological systems.
Simonis is a lead scientist at Dapperstats, an ecological consultant company, and has been showing up at demonstrations collecting munitions as they are dispersed by authorities to test later for chemicals. In September, Simonis identified gaseous zinc chloride found in the smoke grenades used by federal officers in July and posted the results online. If ingested, the chemical can cause trouble breathing, chest pain, and vomiting. Now, Simonis has been sifting through sediment from the river to look for munitions that have made it through the storm drain system.
What I'm particularly interested in is understanding how what gets used up there impacts the organisms down here.
Little is known about the environmental effects of releasing large amounts of chemicals from tear gas and pepper spray. That's a big reason environmental and civil rights groups recently sued the Department of Homeland Security. They want to halt its use of crowd control munitions in Portland until DHS follows a federal law that requires a public environmental review of chemicals being released. On September 10th, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler banned the police force from using CS gas, a form of tear gas that creates clouds of smoke filled with chemicals. The ban came after more than 100 days of continuous demonstrations, but still allows city police to use other types of non-lethal munitions and irritants, like pepper spray. Duke University's Fenn Eric Jort is researching the biological effects of tear gas. He's concerned about the residual effects from the chemicals in a city environment.
We don't know what kind of chemicals are produced when the tear gas is burned and dispersed in the streets.
So far in Portland, the only official findings on the environmental impact of tear gas have come from the city's Bureau of Environmental Services. In August, the agency collected and tested samples of tear gas residue from the downtown area after receiving complaints from the public. Here's spokesperson Diane Dolkin.
We're always concerned about new sources of pollution, and that's why we acted to sample those storm drains and to clean them out.
The agency concluded that some pollutant levels were elevated, but not beyond the range of what's normally found in stormwater before it reaches the Willamette River. Toxic pollutants like cyanide and perchlorate used in tear gas were also detected in some of the sediment and stormwater samples, but the agency said they do not pose an immediate threat to the environment. Simonis, the independent researcher, says more testing needs to be done, especially as Portland has now entered its rainy season.
Really gnarly stuff that isn't just going to move through the ecosystem and then move on. It's going to stay here, and it's going to impact the river and the people for generations.
In mid-September, the city cleaned out 11 storm drains around the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement building in southwest Portland as federal officers continue to deploy crowd control munitions. The area has become a focus of more recent demonstrations. In one held on a Saturday night mid-October, federal officers deployed tear gas and pepper ball munitions at nearly 100 protesters outside of the ICE building. And that is troubling to observers like Jort, the Duke researcher.
It's really shocking that this is continuing like that, and the police is using more and more of these munitions without any kind of second guessing that this might be wrong.
Wrong for people's health and for the environment. For Here and Now, I'm Monica Samayoa.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
India has just become the second country after the United States to exceed 9 million coronavirus infections. To try to stem the rise of cases in the capital of Delhi, the government is going to start door-to-door checks for COVID-19 symptoms. The BBC's Rajini Vijayanathan is on Skype from Delhi. And Rajini, this door-to-door symptom check is not something we've seen here in the United States. How does it work?
Well, we're just hearing about this now, and it will cover 4,500 containment zones, so areas where there might be higher case numbers already, and also areas outside the containment zones where there might be high numbers of cases. And what we've been told is that teachers are being roped in from some schools as part of this exercise, and teams from the government, Delhi government, will be keeping a record of high-risk individuals. So that includes people who are elderly, pregnant women, people with comorbidities, that kind of thing, and they will screen people as well.
And what happens if somebody's found to have symptoms?
That I'm not sure about, to be honest. Again, this is something that we haven't seen in action. We've just heard about this today. So I suspect if somebody is symptomatic, they will then be isolated. The wider context here is cases are spiking here in the national capital.
Well, at one point, India was described as having the world's biggest lockdown. What kind of restrictions are still in place? Because I see that people are getting fined for not wearing masks. And in fact, they're getting fined even more than they were.
Well, it's important to say that there's very much no lockdown here now. There is no lockdown likely around the corner either. And that is because what we saw, as you remember, when that lockdown happened in India in March, was millions of migrants, you know, left without work, walking back to their villages. The huge economic impact of COVID-19 in India really, really was one of the biggest takeaways. And so certainly there is a real balance between lives and livelihoods here in India. And that is why it doesn't look like there's going to be another lockdown. So what we have seen in the last couple of weeks are markets absolutely packed. Hindu Festival of Lights Diwali was last week. People were shopping. And the doctor I spoke to said that he was concerned that the fact that there was no social distancing in these markets would drive up case numbers. And certainly what we're seeing is a rise in cases. The daily rise in cases on Thursday was 7,000, more than 7,500, for example. Some days this week it was 8,000. And what we have had in the last day is now, if you are in public and you're not wearing a mask, the fine has now gone up. It's gone up a huge amount. And also the one thing I should say as well is that on the 1st of November, they had increased the guest allowance for weddings in India. And we actually filmed and recorded for a story at a wedding where they had 200 guests. Now, they had, some of them had said they'd had tests before they'd gone there, but we did see people hugging and embracing, that kind of thing. Well, now, in the wake of concerns over the huge wedding numbers, that's now changed, and there's a limit of 50 guests, which is really, really small for an Indian wedding.
And now that vaccines are on the horizon, is there any talk about how a rollout would happen in a large populous country like India?
Well, I mean, that's the big question, of course. I think what they're saying in India is what we're hearing in other parts of the world, which is healthcare workers and the most vulnerable would be administered the vaccine first. But certainly we're talking about a population of 1.3 billion people. So the exercise at hand, whenever a vaccine is approved, is going to be a vast one.
The BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan, reporting from Delhi. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Climate activists have set a high bar for incoming President Joe Biden. They've asked that the new administration not hire anyone with ties to oil and gas industries. And already, they've been disappointed. Biden has named Representative Cedric Richmond of Louisiana as a senior advisor. Richmond is a former head of the Congressional Black Caucus and has received campaign funds from fossil fuel companies. Varshini Prakash is executive director of the Sunrise Movement and joins us now. And Varshini, do you see any signs in Biden's appointment so far that he's making good on his promise to act on climate?
You know, we were disappointed by the appointment of Cedric Richmond because he has taken hundreds of thousands from oil and gas in his career. But at the same time, I think it points to a larger conversation about the role of the fossil fuel industry and the money from oil and gas donors that has really corrupted and halted any progress on climate action for the last 40 years.
When it comes to policy in this new Biden administration, Biden has said he'll take steps to make the electric sector net zero by 2035. He wants to stop drilling on federal lands. He says he'll rejoin the Paris Agreement on day one. His campaign described this climate plan as the most ambitious of any presidential nominee to date. Why isn't that enough in your view?
Everything that you just said is phenomenal. I felt really excited about the ways in which they improved their campaign plan. They were talking about a $2 trillion investment with 40% of that money going towards disadvantaged communities to move us towards a renewable energy economy. And I think what we've got to ensure is that Joe Biden doesn't wait years or even months before he begins working on this agenda. It's got to be a day one project.
The Sunrise Movement supported Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, but you were part of the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force after Biden got the nomination. Now that he's won the election, how responsive have members of his team been to groups like yours?
Well, we've been working, you know, we have relationships with different members of the campaign internally, but also I think are very clear that we're going to exert external pressure as well. We have a very active grassroots movement of tens of thousands of young people who are terrified for their future and who are ready to ensure that Joe Biden makes good on his Build Back Better plan that they voted for. I think our young people are out and are making very clear that we want climate action to be a day one priority.
The Sunrise website says, quote, Joe Biden has a choice to make. Does he want to be the leader of the American majority or does he want to be Mitch McConnell's vice president? You're making a case for executive actions that don't require the Senate to sign off. What exactly can Biden do without Congress when we talk about all of this?
Yeah, there is so much that Joe Biden can do. One of the first things that he could do is install an Office of Climate Mobilization that reports directly to him and that is based off of the Office of War Mobilization that FDR created in 1943. We saw, you know, the Obama administration begin implementing standards and rules for clean power, for vehicles. Joe Biden could start that on day one. The EPA under the Clean Air Act could work to get towards his clean power by 2035 rule that he put as part of his Build Back Better plan. He could set standards around clean cars that allow for the full phase out of combustion engines within the next two decades, which has, you know, corporate and union backing as well. He could set standards for 100% net zero new buildings by 2030. I mean, these are just some of the examples of what we can do. And sure. I think what we need to understand is what it requires is political will and a hell of a lot of creativity to make it so.
Political will, creativity. If President-elect Joe Biden doesn't take the steps you're hoping for, though, what are you going to do? Stage sit-ins, maybe support primaries of Democratic incumbents? What does climate activism actually look like going forward?
All of the above. We have supported primary victories in the past, and we will continue to do so. We will be in the streets. We will be organizing our communities and our neighborhoods. This moment not only calls upon us to call our politicians to action, but for all of us to recognize the agency that we have right where we live to push forward on this issue.
That's Varshini Brakash, co-founder and executive director of the Sunrise Movement. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, here's a number that may be hard to wrap your head around. We consume about 40 million turkeys every Thanksgiving, but many of us are scaling back this year because of the pandemic. And that's leaving many turkey producers like John Zimmerman in a predicament. You're listening to Sound of John's Turkey Farm in Northfield, Minnesota. P&J Products raises about 200,000 turkeys a year. That's about 3 to 4 million pounds of turkey. And to talk more about this, I'd like to welcome John to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
John, this is usually a busy time for turkey farmers like yourself. How has the pandemic impacted your sales for this holiday?
The uncertainty has been the most challenging, I would say, because the turkeys that the public will consume at Thanksgiving are actually, you know, placed and hatched back in June and July. So the industry had to decide what was Thanksgiving going to be like this year, and trying to figure out exactly what we wanted to do. There's just too many unknowns.
Yes. A lot of your turkey goes to the military, schools, cruise ships. When the pandemic hit, I hear that you had a lot of cancellations. How does this impact the supply chain, and how do you navigate?
Well, early on, you know, in March and April, yeah, there were a lot of cancellations from the food service sector. And we were able to relabel and resell that to a retail sector.
In a normal year, what kind of turkey meat would your consumers want on their Thanksgiving dinner plate?
In a normal year for Thanksgiving, most people like that whole bird, that 10 to 12 pound whole bird. You know, our concern this year was if family gatherings were going to be smaller, does that bird need to be smaller? Or if they were going to be, you know, larger, does it need to be larger? The hope of the industry is that people realize that, you know, turkey can be consumed the other 364 days of the year also, whether it be ground turkey, turkey sausage, turkey bacon, whatever. So our job is just to make sure the consumer has, you know, a myriad level of choices. However they want to consume turkey, we'll make that product for them.
You produce what the consumer wants, but as you alluded to, this is a tricky calculation because you're dealing with living beings being turkeys. And so you're trying to figure out how big you should have them grow to, how small. I mean, how stressful has that been for you over the last few months in trying to make that determination?
Guessing what the consumer wants is always a challenge, but part of it's also education. Like I said, we want to educate the consumer that we can, you know, do different things. Subway sandwiches and deli meat have been very strong this year for different reasons. People are cooking at home more, so we've seen an increased demand for turkeys on the grill, more increased demand and increased interest in smoking turkeys. So that's kind of been a bright spot for the industry, and we'll play to that as much as we can.
A bright spot for the industry that has kind of been trying to get Americans to understand that they can eat turkey all year round, as you mentioned. What happens to turkeys that are not sold? What are your options?
Most supermarkets have contracted their Thanksgiving birds a long time ago. They'll just lower the price and get them sold. And there is more turkey going into cold storage right now because there is a decrease in overall consumption just because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Between freezing and the grocery stores have to handle some of that too. It's taken care of.
Your dad started raising turkeys as a Future Farmers of America project in high school back in the 1950s. You took it over in 1999. P&J Products is a family farm. What are some of your longer-term worries?
We're a smaller operation, and as every industry grows, it becomes more consolidated, more integrated. So we've had to partner with various companies to maintain our relevance, I would say. But you also try to maintain your independence as much as possible. So how do we remain as a small family farm but still remain, you know, economically viable?
The pandemic has completely upended supply chains in so many industries. According to the USDA, the turkey business last year generated about $4 billion in revenue. What do you think the long-term consequences of this moment will be for the turkey industry? And do you think it will be able to bounce back?
It'll take time. And the tail on this pandemic is a lot longer than people realize. Like I said, if there's more product going into cold storage, that's going to affect supplies, you know, even after the pandemic is over, and we'll have to work through that.
That's John Zimmerman. He's the owner of P&J Products, a turkey farm in Northfield, Minnesota. Thank you so much, John, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Please eat a turkey for us.
A lab in Kansas was among the first to get emergency authorization from federal regulators for an easy-to-use COVID-19 saliva test. As Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service reports, getting there took long nights, help from robots, and lots of chocolate chip cookies.
Clinical Reference Laboratory is constantly receiving tubes of saliva by FedEx, by courier. There's even a drop box out front for Kansas City Chiefs fans. To sit in the stadium suites, you gotta turn in your spit before the game. Inside the lab...
Well, hello, I'm Jan Roll.
Stephen Wheeler.
Marianne Michaels.
Are people clad in masks, gloves, and lab coats?
Mr. Weyesa.
My name is Paul Cisse.
Morning, noon, and night, they're ready to open and test packages that can carry the coronavirus. Typically, they turn results in a day. CRL has run more than 200,000 tests so far. It does them for nursing homes and college athletes.
Dancing jazz with her partner, Sasha, it's Justina Machado.
TV shows even lean on the lab for help with testing. But there's no one CRL has tested as many times as this guy.
Yeah, my name's Bruce Dahlquist.
He works on the business side at CRL, and he helped the lab get to where it is by getting sick.
I'd been to Las Vegas, I'd been to Salt Lake, Columbus, Ohio.
Back in March, Dahlquist was traveling for work as the pandemic unfolded.
My trip got cut short.
He got home and started coughing. He got the deep nasal swab, and yep, it was COVID-19. Now, Dahlquist works with scientists, and above all, they wanted him to get well, but they also saw an opportunity. Because nasal swabs freak some people out. They also require gloves and masks.
And we said, there's got to be a better way.
Heather Failing is one of CRL's lead scientists. She and her team wanted to make a different kind of test, and Dahlquist's sickness helped them clear the first big hurdle by giving them a steady supply of samples. Every other day, he set his fluids out on the porch.
Urine, blood, saliva.
Failing came by, put them in a cooler, and went to the lab, and left him a package.
My deal with her was she had to bring me chocolate chip cookies because I lost my sense of taste. Right? And smell, except for chocolate. I could taste chocolate, which was great.
They did this for almost a month. And in that time, CRL found saliva worked really well, which was great because it's so easy for most people to spit into a tube. Dahlquist got well, but CRL still needed lots more sick people to give them spit so they could show their science to the Food and Drug Administration. But that was super hard. Hospitals didn't want them hanging around. Everyone was busy. So CRL folks traveled far and wide to get what they needed. Dallas, Chicago, St. Louis.
And Bruce volunteered to fly out to, what was it?
Dodge City, Kansas.
On a plane. They chartered a plane.
Meatpacking plants in southwest Kansas were fueling huge outbreaks.
So these people were working at the plant shoulder to shoulder, and then they'd go home and, you know, everybody in their family was getting it.
Back at the lab, they ran an endless parade of experiments, working 12-hour days to compile hundreds of pages of test results for the FDA. During that months-long process, CRL bought highly specialized robots to process large volumes of samples. It was a strategic but expensive gamble. The lab couldn't wait and risk delays. Colleges wanted CRL to test returning students, and the fall semester was fast approaching. The robots arrived, which may sound like fun.
Yep, robots playing with spit.
But they're also a lot of work. People like Rob Gerback set to teaching them super precise movements. The machines had to get it just right, within 1/10 of a millimeter, or they could screw up while handling saliva from hundreds of people at once. CRL has nearly 20 of these robots in big glass cases.
Probably 4 feet wide by 7 feet tall by 3 feet deep.
Some always work smoothly. Others can be finicky and frustrating, so the lab workers gave them names. Allison Johnson and Marianne Michaels explain.
This one was Norm because he never really had, as we like to say, a personality. So we named him Norm because he's pretty normal and he just gets it done. This one over here is Elon, named after Elon Musk. Originally, he was like doing really well, and now he kind of just acts like he's better than everyone else.
The robots clean the saliva.
Dumping the stuff that it no longer needs.
And isolate the genetic material needed to spot the virus. Finally, one day in late July, the FDA granted emergency use authorization for CRL's test, the green light that the lab had been waiting for. The long nights of work had paid off.
Just the weight lifted off our shoulders. It was very exciting. I'd never experienced anything like that in lab work.
Rebecca Hankhouse helped write the FDA application. She and her colleagues, like Valerie Stone, feel like they're playing a role in a historic scientific battle.
I feel like I've been preparing my entire life for this pandemic.
She's a senior lab manager.
I went into molecular 16, 17 years ago, knowing that eventually molecular was going to save the future, right? And we're finally seeing it come to fruition. It's just, it's amazing.
For Here and Now, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepsen.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.